as like a case study of a child whose penis was destroyed in a circumcision accident. And the boy never felt like a girl, even though he was raised as a girl. And he had a lot of psychological problems as a result of this harmful experiment of gender reassignment based on the loss of a penis. So it is not a penis, the absence or presence of a penis, that makes someone male, we conclude from unfortunate experiences like this one. There was a family in Canada who tried to not reveal the sex of their baby, and people were hostile and aggressive toward this family. They were enraged that they felt like the family was incredibly destructive to not be willing to label the child as male or female. Some people thought, well, how interesting, and this makes us all think in a different way. But then there were also folks who just had incredible antagonism toward the idea that we wouldn't automatically force our children into boxes based on male or female identity. So children who tend to exhibit more flexible attitudes about gender tend to be female, tend to be older children, adolescents, or young adults, tend to actually interact less with their parents, yet have parents who question traditional attitudes concerning gender-related behaviors. They also tend to have mothers who work outside the home and live in families with children who are all of the same sex, which probably leads to fewer gender-typical chores, if this makes sense. And children who exhibit less flexible attitudes about gender tend to be male, tend to have more interaction with their parents, and have siblings who are of both genders, also to come from traditional homes where mothers are homemakers. When children are raised by two same-sex parents, they have more gender role flexibility, more of a sense of, you know, boys and girls can both do these different types of chores, and these activities are appropriate for both, that there's more flexibility because there isn't such a strong division between two heterosexual parents. So that's not my area of expertise. You know, I think what's coming out, and these are a lot of different researchers who are looking at the different factors, but I think the conclusion may be that there may be some innate factors within gender, and then there are socialized factors, and then there are factors within a given person's experience that may make them more or less flexible. So several layers of influence on the way each of us becomes gendered, so to speak. There are struggles in how other people treat one based on, not, I guess we'd call it gender nonconformity, which restroom to use, who's in your dating pool. You know, these sorts of questions become really complicated for people who are not traditional and where the biological sex is not neatly matched with the felt sense of gender identity. I think one of the more surprising moments for me in parenting was when my middle daughter, Alexa, was just 2 years old. And for some reason, the concept of God was being discussed. And her older sister referred to God as a he. And 2-year-old Alexa said, "What do you mean, Aya? God is a girl," with so much conviction. And it was as though she had heard about the, you know, I guess she had heard the concept of God and just had always internalized God as being a girl, I suppose similar to herself. But, you know, I just thought that was so fascinating that she assigned that meaning to it in her own life at such a young age.
I'm Deb. I'm 51 years old. And I live in Oakland in the Laurel District.
I'm Benjamin. And I live in the Laurel District, and I'm 7, and I'm in first grade, and I'm a fast runner.
So what we've been talking to people about is the difference between boys and girls, and we were wondering, Deb, if you guys have ever talked about that. When did it come up for Benny? Like, did he ever ask you, at what point did he ask you, what are the differences between boys and girls?
I don't think I ever asked.
Yeah, I agree. He has asked some questions that are in that related realm, kind of like, I know sometimes he might ask whether somebody is a boy or a girl, based on, primarily it seems like, hair length.
No.
Yeah, there's one person that you were playing with who had really long, beautiful, blonde hair, and it was really confusing, because even though you knew that person is a boy and loves to play Legos, it was really confusing to you. You kept asking.
I know, because sometimes I forget.
Yeah, and that's okay. There have been some things where he might say someone doesn't do that because they are X or Y. If we actually were to ask whether an X or Y could do something, he might come up with an opinion, but I haven't ever actually pursued that. I think anatomy sometimes comes up. At Benny's preschool, what was the name of the preschool, Benny?
Room to grow.
For a number of reasons, the restroom facility is not behind closed doors.
Only one.
Right, there's one that the teachers use, or adults use. Kids go and do their business, wash their hands, and leave. And no one's staring. It's all very natural and normal. And they were trying to encourage the understanding that people's bodies are different. We're all different. And kind of not make it a taboo kind of thing. There have been a couple of times where he might ask, what is that? Because he hasn't seen that. He has seen our bodies. We have seen his body. We try to, when people ask for privacy, encourage him to respect that privacy. I'm not trying to encourage great curiosity because it's a noble thing. The school definitely was not in... They're not trying to enforce any preconceived notions of what boys or girls could do. There were some kids who did, you know, active things, but they were not all boys. And there are also some kids who like to do quiet things. They're not all girls. And so it was nice for those kids who kind of go between the two preconceived, adult preconceived spaces. They just get to be themselves without being locked into one place or another.
How about colors? What are your favorite colors, Ben?
Colors?
Yeah, like, do you have a favorite, or maybe you like them all?
Green.
Yeah.
Blue, red, and silver, and gold, and black.
Actually, now that he's older, he's feeling a little more comfortable walking into some bathrooms by himself, especially if it's like a single-use bathroom. But there are still some times if we're in a very strange or unfamiliar place that he requires accompaniment. And when I go to the bathroom by myself, my appearance is not a typical woman's appearance. So I get double takes, and I get people who are trying to be helpful. Remind me that I'm not walking into the right one, and I then have to use my very friendly high voice. Hi, I'm good, thanks. Well, when he was little, people were unsure as to his gender, partly because he wouldn't always wear a collared shirt. We had him dressing in, more bright colors, and his hair was just at that place where and people asked all through a certain age, is he a boy or girl? So as long as I would kind of walk in and say, here we go, this is the women and little boys room. So that just kind of announcing to whoever might be in the room and walking in that this is what's going on, that wasn't really an issue. I do perceive, although I'm not always making eye contact, I do perceive that lately, now that he's more obviously boy, and I'm not always, people aren't always understanding where I'm at. I perceive a little bit of a, you're in the wrong bathroom. Oh, no, you're not. That kind of thing. It has been different, the dynamic of having a child with me, the way that I carry myself into a woman's bathroom. I do have a sense of relief that he is comfortable walking into a bathroom by himself, because I just don't, it's just one less thing that I have to steal myself up for. He spends a lot of time with my parents, and so my father takes him to the men's bathroom, but he's always accompanied. And so there was at one point where he said, no, I don't want to go into the women's bathroom, I want to go into the men's bathroom. And I said, okay, that's fine, I'm going to stay right out here, you can go on in, I'll be right here. And most of the time he said, no, let's not do it, because he wasn't comfortable going into the space by himself, so we would go into the women's bathroom together. And so now, for a few years, he knows that he's walking into the bathroom that's not designated for boys. The nice thing about going to, traveling on airplane trips has been that the newer airports have a family bathroom, and then all of us pile in, all of our stuff. And that has raised my own awareness of the gender-neutral bathrooms when I'm traveling. Like I was just on a business trip this week, and the airports that I travel at frequently, I know that there's one, I'm scanning for where it is, and hopefully it's available so I don't have to deal with any of this stuff going in. Because this business trip, I was in a suit, and I don't like wearing dresses. If I had more money, I would have a tailor a, shirts that didn't look so mannish. I mean, actually, I don't really like being called sir, because I'm not a sir. I'm just a different version of a woman. And I understand that people mistake, and most of the time they're apologetic and nice when they realize that they've made an error. And I'm not there with a chip on my shoulder, and I understand why they made the error. And I say something, oh yeah, it's just sometimes just a short hair. I mean, it's kind of, they did something to make it more human, right? I'm just a person. It's okay. You made a mistake. We'll just keep going on. It does make me nervous when and if I travel to other parts of the country that are not Boston, not New York City, not San Francisco, but in the parts of the country where people might think that I'm trying to be something that I'm not trying to be, right? And then they might get defensive. That's not what I'm trying to do. We purposefully started out doing our best to avoid gender identity roles to the point of we wouldn't know what sex he was in the womb. It wasn't until he came out that we realized, we're like, yay, the baby's born, and here I am, have this squiggly football-sized baby, and I have to hold him up and say, oh, you're a boy. And then, we had been spending 9 months basically being open to whatever kind of child this child wants to become. It's been really fascinating to us how much he has picked up and how much he inherently has within him to be a boy. We were deliberately giving, non-gender specific toys, non-gender specific clothing, non-gender specific, reading stories and going back and forth and just not trying to cast anyone in any specific place. And yet, what seems to me to be very true for the traditional boy is to be very interested in things that move. Traditional girl is be more interested in the relationships between their dolls and such. And we have had some other parents, we've known some other parents who managed to navigate that maybe more successfully than we have, or have had children who are not quite so, their own selves are more, atypical isn't the word I want to use, but more, non-conforming. Another boy who might wear a skirt. So just to close that, he has his own self-identity seems surprisingly to be, self-determined to a large part. I mean, and there's whatever he picks up from being at someone else's house. And we weren't watching a lot of TV when he was little, so it was whatever he picked up from other kids. Just as we've all grown on this and traveled on this journey, there are things, he spends a lot of time with my father, so he'll come home and he'll start to shave, because my dad shaves. I don't shave. We've gone to, been on a cruise and had to dress up for dinner, and I wore a tuxedo. And for like a year after that, Benny just loved dressing up in a suit.
I still do.
Well, you do. I haven't seen you do it lately, sweetie. For a school picture, last school year, he wore a suit and a tie. I could tell that some of that was watching what I was doing and kind of modeling that. It's interesting for me just to kind of see what he's picking up on, what it means to be a woman. He's got two moms. And then what he takes from that in terms of what he needs to find or understand about what it means to be a boy or to grow up and to be a man. Which will be interesting. The only role model he has right now is his grandfather on a family basis. He has male teachers at school and fathers of his friends, but he doesn't live with them. I don't know what kind of questions he asks them.
Excuse me, sir. Over by the stall. Wrong bathroom. The man is down the hall.
Five Unexpected Gender Differences in Children's Clothing by Catherine D.M. Clover. Difference number 2. The garments are often cut differently. The shape of clothing from male to female toddlers are completely different, even though at this age, boys and girls are shaped more or less the same. This one has an easy explanation. They're cut that way to mimic the clothing of male and female adults. The 4-year-old doesn't need to be dressed in what society views as sexy for a 22-year-old. Why is it that a long-sleeved t-shirt from the boys' section is square and boxy with loose sleeves that allow for plenty of movement, and the same item for the girls' section has tight sleeves, a plunging neckline, and might even be cinched at the waist?
Hi, my name is Soraya Shamali, and I am a writer and an activist. I write primarily about social justice issues, specifically about the role of gender in public life, particularly media, technology, religion, and that often ends up meaning automatically intersections with race, class, sexuality. The thing that we're going to be talking about today is specifically children and media, based on an article that I wrote a few years ago called What Does It Mean? Most children's books are still about white boys. What strikes me over and over and over again is how quickly our ideas about identity, entitlements, ambitions, confidence, how early on they're formed. So I looked at children's books as a way to think about what children were looking at and seeing, whether they could find themselves reflected in culture. And I think that they really can't. And usually we talk about movies or games, but movies and games still largely are derived from books, even though people don't think so much of children reading books as much. The fact is that they do read books, and those books then turn into all of these other products. I got a pretty overwhelmingly positive response because people wanted the information and wanted, I think, to think about how that information played out in their own lives, whether it's in their libraries at home or school or a public library. But I also got some really strong negative responses. Some people just refuse to believe it's true, even though, as I cited in the piece, there are now, you know, decades of work in this area looking at this and studying what the numbers really look like in terms of books that are published. And there's really no controversy about it. I mean, the numbers are the numbers. So it is interesting to see what makes people upset. There's been no huge changes, frankly, as far as I see, and I try and keep an eye on this kind of research. You know, when we make decisions about books, what decisions are we making? Are we thinking about these things? And I still see one of the problems being, however, that a lot of people think, or they'll say, yes, this is important. And then the next thing they'll say is, girls need girl role models, or black children need black role models. And that's actually part of the problem in my mind, because I don't think that only girls need girl role models. Everybody needs girl role models. Little boys need girl role models. You know, white children need to have people and characters and representations of black people or brown people in their lives that show that they're equally human, and be able to empathize in those ways. And so I'm heartened by some of the changes that I've seen, but I think in terms of whether or not publishing has radically been altered in that time frame, I'd say no. I still go into libraries where they have boys' books and girls' books, and we know from lots of other studies in sociology and anthropology that the earlier you segregate children's communities, the more likely those children are to bully, the more likely they are to think of, in terms of binary sex, oppositional sex, to think in terms of stereotypes. And that in turn feeds all kinds of other forms of discrimination, racial discrimination, homophobia. And so when I see a school library where there are books for boys and books for girls, to me, that really indicates a much deeper problem with awareness of how these issues are all related. If you look at banned book lists over the course, let's say, of the last 20, 30 years, or just take a look randomly, even recently, the ones that I looked at, and this is anecdotal, I haven't seen any longitudinal studies about this, but it's pretty consistent. They tend to feature really disproportionately books about girls or books written by women about topics that are considered obscene or shameful because they have to do with issues of rape or sexuality. One of the books right now that is becoming, that's you know, in the news a lot is The Handmaid's Tale. Handmaid's Tale is one of the most banned books in schools today. So the percentages that we see, and I'll just read some of them here, but for example, 57% of children's books published each year have male protagonists versus 31% female. The others have animals or robots or, you know, non-gendered, non-human characters. This is quite similar to television and film, where books that also have animated characters tend to also reflect racial, gender, and sex biases. So, for example, we know that animated animals, there are many popular children's books that have animated animals. 100% of them have male characters, but less than a third have female characters. Even if you look at book titles, there are twice as many book titles that contain the names of boys and men for children than girls and women. And so those numbers then turn into movies. I think the first thing people should do is maybe take a look at their own purchasing habits. That's easy, right? You look around your house. If you're a book buyer, if your child is reading books from the library, if you're giving books to children, be conscious of the books that you're giving them. And be kind of thoughtful about why this is important, if this is something that you think is important. Similarly, it's entirely possible for parents and teachers to audit the way books are collected and represented in institutions like libraries and school classrooms. As I mentioned, that those levels of segregation, they tend to happen not out of malice, but either habit or a lot of times I'll hear a librarian say, well, we want more boys to be reading and they have to have boys' books. And I find that kind of gobsmacking. I'm like, actually, no, they don't have to have boys' books. You can actually have a substantive conversation with boys about why it is that that's an idea, what it means. It's an opportunity as opposed to a loss. But those things really require adult intervention. They require taking the time and making the effort to address institutional issues because they start really early. You know, if you're a parent and you go into your school library and you see that books are organized this way, that should be an opportunity to say, hey, can we talk about why this is and why it's detrimental? I have to admit, I know this sounds so cliche, but I really, really did love Pippi Longstocking. She broke all the rules I felt I couldn't break at that age, right? She was just so outrageous all the time. And I also, you know, Peter Pan is, I actually write about Peter Pan because it's such a difficult story in so many ways, particularly in terms of stereotype and gender. And I loved all of the characters in Peter Pan, every single one of them. And it was pretty funny because I kind of, as a child, I always wore my hair in two braids, and Tiger Lily wore her hair in two braids, you know. There weren't a lot of characters that looked like me and wore their hair like that, so I had this particular affinity for her. It didn't occur to me as a 5-, 6-, 7-year-old that she was portrayed as a kind of jealous exotic. I just loved her, right? I mean, why wouldn't I? You know, there are some great organizations now that are trying to get diverse books and diverse stories into the hands of children younger and younger. Yeah. So things like First Books or In This Together Media, I just think they're doing terrific work.
Neverland!
Oh, yes.
Well, who else lives there, Peter?
The Lost Boys.
Who are they?
They are the children that fall out of their carriages when the nurse is looking the other way. If they are not claimed in 7 days, they're sent far away to Neverland. I'm captain, you know.
Oh, what fun it must be.
Yes. But we are rather lonely.
Oh?
You see, Wendy, we have no female companionship.
Are none of the others girls?
No. Girls, you know, are much too clever to fall out of their carriages.
We would like to thank everyone who took time out of their busy lives to talk to us. Tripti Kamath, Abhijit Zayi and Mira Shah, Shelley and Coleman Romales, Kate Kapinski, Deb, Jen, and Ben, and Soraya Shamali. On Children, a poem by Khalil Gibran, was read by Margot Breyer, and Adina Goldstein read excerpts from the article Five Unexpected Gender Differences in Children's Clothing by Catherine D.M. Clover. Special thanks to Isaac Master, Sue Jean Halverson, and Stan Chang. Music by Alan Silvestri, Concrete Blonde, Tamika Reed, Bart Hopkin, Tribe 8, and Baba Yaga. We also want to give special thanks to Kate Raphael and the Women's Department of KPFA for allowing us to present this program. Part 2 of Engendered Opinions, or Excuse Me, Are You a Girl or a Boy, will air this August. This program was produced by Emily Charles and Mary Salome of Queer in Your Ear Productions.
Listening to CJSF 90.1 FM broadcasting from Bern.
This is Bird Note. Author Kira Jane Buxton loves crows. So much that she's written two novels about a crow named ST, navigating the extinction of humanity. When she was writing those books, she tried befriending the crows in her neighborhood and wound up bonding with a pair of them.
They are a dyad, a paired male and female. I call them T and Dart, and they have honestly become family to me. T in particular, the female, she's incredibly clumsy. She drools when she eats. She's very quirky. She used to love to call for me out the front porch, and then I would come out and she would hide and I'd have to try and find her. And then she'd do a kind of jump scare and pop out at me. That was her favorite thing for a while. And her partner, Dart, is a very handsome crow. He's a little bit more aloof. She'll come right up to me. He will watch and keep an eye out for her. And she will eat all the food and share nothing. And he always shares his food with her. It reminds me a lot of my relationship with my husband. You know, he's gregarious and altruistic, and she just wants to eat all the snacks. It took a long time to garner the trust of these two birds, and now we have this sort of reciprocity of respect.
Many details of her crow-tagonist in her novels, Hollow Kingdom and Feral Creatures, are drawn from T and Dart. You can find links to those books at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mark Bramhill.
Listen to music and podcasts from CGSF 90.1 FM with our radio app. It's on-the-go listening made easy. You can tune into all our music, spoken word, and multicultural shows using your device. Our app lets you set reminders so you'll never miss your favorite show again. Stay connected to CGSF 90.1 FM through our community radio app. Download the app from the Apple Store or get it on Google Play.